Well, welcome to another session. We're talking about decision making, which is really talking about Christian worldview and values and how they apply to life. So we're going to start looking at our chart again, the decision making chart. I know if you're listening to the podcasts or whatever they call it, you'll be at a disadvantage without the chart. However, it is in the book. I don't remember. I should have looked the page number up, but it's the big chart that takes up an entire page, somewhere about one third of the way in, and with all the little blocks and so forth on it. If you're real serious with your listening, what page is that?
65.
Page 65 in the book. You can always contact us, and we'll find a way to get you these charts if you'd like to have them. Let's have prayer as we begin. Our Heavenly Father, we pray now that you'll give us the ability to think and reflect this evening on this information and to discuss its implications for us. We thank you that you haven't left us alone. You've given us your word, and you've created us in your image with the expectation that we would take seriously the processing of decisions in our world. Pray for Dave and Carol and their community in light of some possible problem there this evening. Pray for X, who may be in transition to the study. We thank you for the privileges that we enjoy. Pray you'll give us wisdom in our various tasks through the week in Christ's name. Amen. All right, now, here again, this bottom block, this huge block, is basically your mind. This is what needs to go on inside of your thinking process. Most of us go through life and we make decisions, as it were, sort of out of thin air, but it's never out of thin air. We make them on the basis of everything we've become as a person up to that point, and the way we have of doing things. I can be very anal in processing things. But when springtime comes and the car has 100,000 miles on it, I get this itch, as any good man would, when you pass a car lot, to go in and take a look. And as much as I can analyze things, sometimes I have this tendency to make a pretty quick decision. Case in point, Gloria and I proposed on our second date. And we didn't want to push it, so we waited a couple of months before we got married, back in college. But I'd been in the Navy, and in the Navy they teach you to make decisions. Don't halt between opinions, but get on with it. And so, consequently, I can be a little impetuous when it comes to things like that because I just want to get it done and get on with something that I view as more worthwhile. And sometimes I look back at those decisions and wonder what I was doing. It's like one of my colleagues on a video that the students did when I retired said, "I'm the only person who decided to quit work and move to Florida in the middle of one of the worst recessions the country had ever seen." And, you know, what kind of decision-making is that? Well, you know, we all ask ourselves that in hindsight sometimes. So critical self-awareness, I can't emphasize that too much. It may seem to be a little bit of an Almond Joy candy bar. It's indescribably delicious, but what does it mean? But it means to do what I just did. Engage yourself a little bit. Are you an impetuous person? Do you overanalyze? In golf, they call it analysis paralysis. You stand over the ball so long that you never really get to hit it. And when you do, it goes astray because you spent too long thinking about it. And there's both ends of that continuum can apply. Knowing who we are as people. Are we good listeners? I'm not a real good listener because I'm always thinking about what the conversation is about and forget to listen. And all of us do this. When someone is talking to us, we're thinking about what we want to ask them or whatever, and we don't really engage them. It's a real gift to be able to listen well and completely. And it's a discipline. We need to discipline ourselves to do that. I mentioned to you that my critical self-awareness was spiked a bit when I got out of the Navy and got this complete history of my 4 years in the service from the officers that supervised the area in which I worked. And there was one thing I didn't mention to you that was pretty consistent in all of the reviews, was that they praised me on discipline, doing my work, doing what I'm told, and so forth. But they always added this little proviso at the end that I'm a little stubborn if I don't agree with their opinion about the issue. And, you know, when you're in the military, you don't disagree with the officers too much. But I guess I must have pushed back more than I ever realized in doing that. There's probably notes, Axel, that you'll want to check later. But for right now, we're going through this chart. We're in the bottom box. So knowing ourselves is probably one of the biggest battles in that process. Now, if you're married, you've got to know each other. Marriage is the most difficult place on the planet to communicate because it's the biggest risk. It's the biggest risk because if you really say what you're thinking, what's the other person going? How they're going to hear that? You know, what people never really hear, they sort of translate words. I remember in my preaching experience, I'd be standing at the door greeting people, and someone would leave and tell me what a wonderful sermon it was, and then they'd tell me what it was, and it didn't have anything to do with what I had said. That is the challenge of communication, to get people to hear what you say, and even greater is to process it. It's like the old shoe commercial, often imitated, never duplicated. It's very, very difficult to do the process of communication. And we all need a lot of work on that, but we need self-awareness of ourselves in that arena. We were talking about human obligations. Decision-making is different if you're single, if you're married with kids, and if you're married with children and other family responsibilities come your way. And the Bible actually has text and illustrations in it about people who struggled with those various categories. I mentioned in passing but didn't explain that in Corinthians and also in the pastoral epistles, the obligations of marriage trump some other things you may think is more important, such as prayer. Read 1 Corinthians 7 clearly, that you can't use spiritual categories as a way of putting off your spouse. That's not spiritual. And so, and Paul was pretty blunt about the truth of marriage, and we all know it's true. There's not a freedom in marriage as there is when you're single. I mean, it's just obvious. You know, you got two people. How do you negotiate those things? It's not so hard in perhaps the early years, but everybody, as we progress in marriage, realize that we have incompatibilities. How do you deal with incompatibilities? You know, I mean, Gloria and I are probably pretty obvious to a lot of people. She doesn't like to have dinners at home, and I just enjoy doing that greatly. Kind of like, you know, Kelly loves to have the dinners, and Alex, you know, she stands back and watches those things. So, you know, but what do you, as you grow older in marriage, your incompatibilities can submarine the entire marriage if you don't learn how to live with incompatibilities. And that's not an easy thing to do. You try to make space for each other, let each other do what they like to do, you find yourself sometimes going in different directions. Well, that can bring a lot of decision making to the surface. Then you have children. You know, you have to think as a church, and leaders need to think about this. You're not going to build multi-million-dollar buildings with young families with five kids, for example. And you have to be very careful. How do you approach the issues of giving as young families are struggling just to pay the bills? I have to tell you that I get kind of irritated sometimes in this with the domain of what they call tithing. Tithing is an Old Testament principle. The money went to the temple in Jerusalem and to the government that ran Jerusalem. It was about 28%. That's about what most of us in the lower income brackets pay for taxes. It was a civil situation. I would be very glad if all of that was still in vogue, because if it was, you'd be giving me a check every month because I'm a Levite. Okay? So, but how do you handle that with young people who are struggling without, to help them not to feel guilty when they can't achieve what they would like to do, perhaps? And how do you handle it with seniors who are on fixed incomes? How do you handle seniors that if they, these two 80-some-year-olds who are single and want to, they're just, they were really after companionship, but if they get married, they'll lose half their income because of the way Social Security works. Pastors in retirement communities face those kinds of things. So you, this whole thing about decision-making becomes complicated when you get into the social structures. But you still are doing it on the same principle, the principle of biblical worldview and value sets. And you know what happens usually? When you really start probing that stuff, you discover that most of our stereotypes don't stand up very long. When I pastored a church in Indiana, when that church started, everything was hunky-dory in the world. And all of the leaders' children were small. They took a very stiff view of the questions of divorce. Basically said, we don't even recognize that category. I became pastor when most of these individuals had children who were in their 20s. Married and some what? Divorced. And one day, they had a congregational forum with deacons like elders, came to me and said, "Pastor, we'd like you to rewrite our constitution." And I said to them, smarter than my age at that time, I said, "I'll help you to rewrite it. You're going to be here forever. I'm going to be here for a certain amount of time." And we worked through that process, and it was interesting to watch those who had been so adamant all of a sudden, because of their own life situations, had a different view. And that different view actually helped them to find the text differently than they had found it before. Not that the text had changed, but that the pressure that we come to look at the text is at a different place. That gets tedious. The elders looked through some of these issues, and I gave them some articles and things, and those articles point out how much things have changed. Even John Piper's church. John Piper holds a different view of this issue of divorce and remarriage than the young leaders of his church. And he sort of acquiesces to them. He's sort of out of the situation now. But it was very interesting. I got some inside literature while I was doing that research, and some documents that were in-house with Bethlehem Church. And it was very interesting to see how opposed they were. And yet, I guess you could say, on one hand, Piper had the maturity to step aside as new leadership comes into place. But it was, there's still more conversation to be had. It's not an easy subject. And so human obligations and families can get more complicated because of the multiple families that's so common with our current culture. So you, in a sense, have to study the scriptures to know who you are, to know what it means for your place in life with family and career, and decisions have to be many times made from that set of values than another value. You can't act like a single person when you're married, and you can't act like a married couple with no children, and a lot of different kinds of obligations that become pretty heavy, because there are values in Scripture for all those categories. Here's another one. Circumstantial providence. I really put a lot of weight on this. You always have trouble as a teacher with students who like to take cuts. Most catalogs have a system. You can have three cuts during a 15-week semester or something like that. And the teacher really doesn't have control of that because the administration makes those decisions. And but I always put in my syllabus a little section on attendance. And part of it was that you're expected to be here unless negative providence intervenes. Well, you know, I could tease them and say negative providence could mean that you passed away the night before, and so therefore you can't be in class the next day. It could mean a bad bout of the flu, but it doesn't mean that you overslept. I make fun out of it, but I get my point across. I had some students, there were two of them, they were both Cuban refugees, and they lived in Miami, and they came to seminary. And they'd come bopping into class 15 minutes late consistently. So after a few times of that, I locked the door. And there is glass in the door. And, you know, they're on there. And I just kind of ignored it. I had warned the class. I said, don't look. Just leave them alone. And, you know, they were never late again after that for some crazy reason. And so you can make it fun. But circumstantial providence. One illustration in our life was in the early 90s, Grace Theological Seminary deconstructed along denominational lines, and they released the entire faculty except for those who were heavy in the denomination. There were about a half dozen of us that were starting to look for jobs. And I hadn't done that. Every job I'd ever had, it was an invitation, and I was somewhere else and wasn't thinking all that much about moving. But this was the first time, in a sense, I'd been fired. To put it bluntly, with the whole faculty was gone. A lot of issues involved here. But anyway, it was right before a professional conference, and I still remember going to that conference. It was in San Diego. And just, you know, I didn't sleep very much and thought about a lot of things and what am I going to do. And I started, I had had a lot of pastoral opportunities, but not right at that moment. But so I sent out some resumes to some churches and discovered they weren't all that interested. And I was kinder and gentler back in those days. I thought maybe they might like me. And the ones that had liked me and had offered something before had already filled things. And so I started sending out invitations to schools. And we went through the process. We made a decision. And I think it was a good decision. And it ended up being a good but brief situation. But as soon as we made the decision, I had about three offers. And some really nice ones, too, to go to a school on the West Coast and be involved with a foundation that worked with particularly in the former Soviet countries at that time. And another school had made me an offer in one thing or the other. But we stuck with it. But it wasn't, but for about 3 years, and then another invitation came, and it was obvious that it was a much better fit than what was there. So circumstantial providence, timing means a lot. And you can't allow yourself, I don't think, to be the kind of person who makes a decision and then 2 weeks later another thing comes and you say, well, I wish I'd have taken that, so I'll give up on what I just decided on. No, you engage it, you live for the glory of God, because within providence... And providence is a part of a category of sovereignty, but it's sort of how life flows. There's something for you to learn in the situation that you find yourself in, and to do the best you can in that regard. Sometimes you back up and punt after a while. Other times you stick it out for a long, long time. And no matter what kind of a job it is, the same thing is true. The issue of timing, the issue of where you are in life at a certain point is a major, major factor. And nobody can answer that very well except for you in terms of how you manage life. But the fact is that nothing takes God by surprise, but we don't have to find out ahead of time what that big plan is. We live, we obey, we process, we act. Sometimes we say maybe not the smartest thing, and maybe in a period of time we back up and do it again. But that's all part of the process and part, I think, of God's design to teach us a variety of things that we wouldn't learn if we had not been there. There was a school in Columbia, South Carolina, called Columbia Bible College back in those days. It has another name now. They've all changed their names. But there was a fellow that was president named McQuilkin. He was an elderly gentleman, had done a really good job with the school, and now he was retiring. He had a son who was rather prominent as a missionary in Japan. And the whole board said to President McQuilkin, "We want your son to come and be president." Now, the son was not a 20 or 30-something. He was in his 40s or so. Had a PhD, I believe, at that time. And the father said to his board, "Thank you, but he hasn't suffered enough yet." That was the phrase. He hasn't suffered enough yet. And later on, that same McQuilkin became president of the school. And, you know, that became sort of a talking point from time to time, that he still had things that he needed to do. I've, in my own life, turned down pastorates because, frankly, I hadn't suffered enough yet. And I just knew that, you know, it didn't fit my flow and calling, if you please. But I'm at the point in life now, maybe it would be more interesting now. Maybe it would work better now. But it probably wouldn't, because I'd be pastoring millennials, and that probably wouldn't go so well. All right. Circumstantial providence. You have any illustrations about that in your own life? We all, as we bang around, yeah.
I guess the question I have for you is, what would you do different, knowing what you know now, if you could go back when you learned that, hey, my time is numbered here, and was it grace?
Yeah.
I have to get a new job. What, even though you agree with your decisions, how would you tell yourself, mentor yourself, to think differently in that situation?
Now?
Yes.
Well, it wouldn't be a whole lot different, I don't think. I had actually been thinking about these categories. I hadn't thought as much. I wasn't where I am now. But it would have processed pretty much the same way. Okay. You send out your feelers, you know, when you're job searching. I don't think, you know, I might think now, you know, if I got that opportunity now, I'd have just told that school, "I'm sorry, but I'm not coming." But that wouldn't have been the right thing to do, because they were already, I already signed, they were already counting on me. The interesting thing is, when I left that school, I had signed the week before. And the dean of the school that wanted me to come, he communicated with the dean of the school where I was and got his permission for me to be released to go. The fellow wasn't all that happy about it, I don't suppose. But it, you know, I didn't totally make that decision myself on that score, but was happy with the outcome. And it proved to be the best thing over the years, because that other situation basically disintegrated as a number of different faculty left in time. So we all have those decisions. I'm sure Pepper's got some stories.
I've got a lot of stories. In fact, I was thinking about sharing a couple of them because I feel like I have a lot of what you described as circumstantial providence. The first three or four, maybe five airlines I worked for all declared bankruptcy and abruptly went out of business and left me without a job.
Yeah.
After I thought that each one of them was going to be my lifetime career. And the first one was the best job that I ever had. It was a real small airline. Everybody really enjoyed working together, based out of Monterey, California, which was paradise. And that job abruptly went out of business. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you've ever worked for a company that declares bankruptcy, after you've poured your life into it, when they lock the doors, they treat you like you're one of the, the enemy. Uh-huh. But what I did on the first one is, and it was very difficult to find another airline job at that time, but that job was so great, and I was so sad on losing that job that I spent probably 6 months in mourning and really not wanting to get out there and work to find another job.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, it happened three or four times after that. And what I learned is when it happens, you don't have time to lose yourself in sadness. You have to pick up and get going.
Yeah.
And let that part of your life go by.
So part of a value in that regard is that when we don't control our circumstances at the end of the day, by and large. We have some control, and I think God told Adam and Eve to manage the earth, as it were. So we have a lot of responsibility as far as control in our own circumstances, but there are points in life, and we all face these from time to time, that we've lost all the control. And now what do? Well, it's the circumstance. The morals haven't changed. The expectations of fellowship with God and obedience and all that hasn't changed. But the exigencies of life have changed in big ways. When the faculty at that one seminary was completely released, you don't have any control over that. And, of course, you go through all kinds of phases of, well, we're going to call the accrediting agency. Well, they didn't have the right one. They didn't have the one that specialized in theological education, so therefore there was no power to call the administration to task. And so lots of things happen, but at the end of the day, circumstantial providence is a major piece of everybody's life. Don't fight it, engage it, deal with it, and the basics of living the Christian life don't change. But what changes is just your environment, your geography, and it may not be comfortable, but at the end of the day, these things usually work out in positive ways for us. I think the best thing that ever happened to me in some ways was that deconstructed school, because I had gotten pretty comfortable, and I was doing my job, and I think using it reasonably well, but I was stagnant. I needed to be pushed out into new settings and forced into other things. And that's a part of life. I don't know what the stats are right now, but it's been a little while ago since I've known this. But in my generation, career changes, lifetime during the life, maybe two or three career changes. Now, I've been a teacher. Job changes aren't career changes. Been an airline pilot. That's not a career change. It's a job change. But last time I heard, it's 6 to 8 career changes in the average person's life now. Our culture is so staccato, as they say, as music does. You kind of do it, you get bored with it, and you just completely change and do something else rather than just changing the job. That leaves a very unstable culture, I think. But nonetheless, that's what we have. Here's another one. Researched opinion about your current issue. When you're in the process of making of decisions, research is a part of it. There's research in the Bible. Say you have a child, and that the child has been a reasonably good child, but now they've gone into transgender and they're going to get married. And your son, who's no longer a son, is going to have a baby. How are you going to handle that situation? What is God's will for you in relation to your relationship to your child? How do you process that? Not just emotionally, as parents would do, but from the standpoint of what is a principled way not to lose the child, but not to just fold in terms of your values about life and the nature of life. Research is a huge piece of being a Christian. Lawyers, not so much as in the past, and Christians are in the same category of paper chase. There was a cartoon one time in Christianity Today that American pastors had offices and English pastors had libraries. And it was a slam against the mega church deconstruction of the academic piece of church. And so this thing about research is so crucial. And yet, it's not normal for most people, because most folks are not, unless you're a teacher, it's just not something you're used to doing. And I would love at some point to have time, and whether it be an adjunct to Wednesday or an adjunct to Sunday school, where maybe three people come and we go in the library that's being built over here. And I show you how to find answers to your questions. That it's not as daunting as you might think, and it's actually fun to do that. It's not for everybody, but it's part of the responsibility of being a Christian, because being transformed by the renewing of your minds is not a spectator sport. It calls for engagement. Researched opinion about your current issue. Any issues that, it don't have to be your issue, but any issues you just want to put on the table that we might think about on that category. What would you do, for example?
Talking to other people.
You?
Talking to other people, like mentors, and asking them for advice.
Yeah.
Older mentors, mm-hmm. have been kind of in your situation, not exact situation, but...
Correct.
Career change, a lifestyle change.
Mm-hmm. That's very much a part of it. I have that, actually, that one is down in the bottom in the middle. I'm going to hold it out for a moment here. That is a part of research, but it is the easiest research, isn't it? Okay, what do you all think? I can answer it, but you want to make some comments. The question is, say someone comes to your church, wants to be active. They are a latent homosexual who has thoughts but no actions, and they know Jesus as their Savior. So if you were the pastor, what would you do to prepare to help this person?
I don't know, because I had a friend who actually came to me. We were both Christians.
I doubt if there's anybody in this room that doesn't have alternate sexualities in their immediate family, which would be, you know, close relatives. There's nobody. And have you ever noticed that some of the most artful people are those of alternate sexual choices? Have you ever noticed that? Nice people. There's another side to all that, by the way. I won't tell you about going to the Navy Y and getting notes under the door. But what would I do if I were doing that as a pastor? Well, the first thing I would do, if I hadn't already done it, I would have to prepare myself to understand what does the Bible actually say about this issue. Now, that has been really strung out here over the last 20 years. We have a views book. I believe that one is over there. I've tried to get all of them in there. That actually looks at this question and has several writers who are Bible scholars, one of them who actually is pro-homosexual, who answers that question of what does the Bible say? And I don't think this question is one of those kind that you can say, well, pay your money and take your pick. I think there's good hermeneutical, interpretive approaches to what the scriptures actually say and what they actually mean, both in the Old Testament and in the New. To me, it's so clear, I just don't understand how some scholars can try to work around it. And there's all kinds of gyrations to do that. People have written books, of course, for those kinds of things. But my responsibility as a leader who would respond to this person would be to know what are the views. And this would be true for that question. It would be true for someone coming in and asking, I can't afford to have a burial. I want to be cremated. Is that okay? Or someone coming in and they're pregnant. How are you going to do it? Every question comes back to this thing, and what are the views? And those view books are very helpful on that. You'll always find an arrangement of these things. But I need to know what the field is. The views equals the field of understanding. And you would expect that everybody uses the same Bible and the same verses and comes to different opinions. But that's not all equally either appropriate or cogent. And it's not just in the multitude of sources. In other words, I got 30 people who hold view A and only 5 who hold view 2B. So it is an activity of ministry leaders who are trained to do that kind of activity and pursue those kinds of activities. That would be my first role. Okay, now once I've made my decision that, for example, the Bible disapproves of alternative sexual lifestyles, my next approach is to the person as a person and to talk to them about their feelings. Here, I would even like to pull in a counselor that I would have respect for that can help the person to know themselves. I'm not sure they have a total critical self-awareness, and you have to work on that. But I would work them through the text kindly and talk to them about their choices. And one of the things in my mind that I would make a big part of the conversation would be, what is the effect of Adam's sin in the world? We call it the fall. Everything in this world, even the things we disagree with, that would be not in consort with Scripture, are a result of the fall. People's feelings about how they're born You know, they talk about this domain. Is it nature or nurture? That's the little phrase. Is it nature? I was born this way, or is it nurture? I was manipulated or moved into this category of life for some reason. Well, frankly, it's probably both. But how could it be nature? Because of the fall. I wouldn't go so far as to say that some of these things are genetic and DNA and all that sort of thing. I don't know anything about that, so I can't speak to it. But the fact is that every deviation that pulls people, and this must be a sincere person by the question, that pulls people in certain directions has to be confronted with the fact that the traction of our will is in the direction of our nature, and our nature is a problem. And to work with an individual, to think about that, and my hope would be, the least of my hope would be that they would at least come to see the views and to understand that they can't just choose a view. They have to, because this is a little different category, they have to choose a view which best represents the teaching of Scripture. They may decide that one of those other persons does that and go that direction. But my duty is that not to make them change. My duty is to give them an opportunity to think through the issue. And that individual is responsible to do that for themselves. Make them read. Make them think. Don't just tell them. When I used to do a lot of evangelism in our early life between schools, I never witnessed to someone without making them read the verses in the Bible. I want them to read them and to read them out loud, because there's a way of the moving from the eye into the head. It haunts you a little more. It gets your attention. And I think the same thing would be true with dealing with this sort of person. Because I'm not going to try to push against their desires, because I don't have any, I'm not naive about their desires. Their desires are the desires of a fallen person. And consequently, they have to engage that. And there are some, I haven't been that close to this domain. I have some friends who are leaders in trying to help people. But there are many who have struggled with this and have been able to maintain biblical values while facing that challenge. It isn't really that much of a different challenge than a single person facing the challenge of abstinence. It's certainly a different category. But each category has its challenge, and each is responsible for obedience to the teaching that's involved in the total worldview and value system of the Christian in that regard. That's the only thing I know. I think that, now, does a person need professional help? Well, they do, to know themselves and why. I haven't done much counseling, but I did have an interesting situation. And when I was a pastor of a pretty large church in Indianapolis, I was interim for a year, and then they got a guy and he didn't last, and I went back for another year. And I counseled with this individual while I was at the church on the weekend. I got his permission, and I taped it. And then I went back to the school, and I sat down with Larry Crabb, and we listened to that conversation. And he helped me to see what I heard and what I didn't hear. That's the amazing thing about someone who's really skilled at listening. What I didn't hear. At the end of the day, this guy was having all kinds of problems with sexual fantasies at his office, everywhere in life. He was married to an absolutely drop-dead gorgeous woman. But he was having trouble with sexual fantasies. And he comes in and tells me I can solve his problems. Well, there's your first manipulation. That ain't going to happen, you know. But the fact is that as we work through that, I was helped in working with this individual to help that individual come to a critical self-awareness that the problem wasn't the sexual fantasies. The problem was that he wasn't being the kind of husband that he should have been with his wife. And as a result, he was looking for an alternative universe in which he could have control and power. It's really a crazy thing. But when he saw that, it made sense. And when he lost that category, he also lost the need for it in other ways. Now, a fallen human being is going to have problems in that domain. Most people will. I don't care who you are or what you are. That's the nature of life. But the fact is that that individual changed and the marriage improved as a result of coming to that critical self-awareness through a process. Now I've kind of forgotten the question. Well, that was Rex's original question, but didn't I thought you just made a comment, Kelly? No? Okay. Well, anyway, I'll move on. So, listen, researched opinion never quits. When in education we talked about lifelong learners. And one time we had a whole weekend of faculty meetings to come to one conclusion. A good teacher is a curious learner. I mean, that is massive. If you lack curiosity to know, when something confronts you and you let it go, you have lost opportunity. And when you're old like me, you got to write it down so you don't lose the opportunity. You can go look at it later, you know. But the fact is that that is at the very foundation of being a good decision maker, is the fact that you do seek, you seek research. Look at your theological tradition and understandings are part of your decision-making process. The church that you land in, you're not always going to agree with everything. But that's where you are. And the diversity of good churches and good denominations is huge, both in England and America. That's kind of the world most of us live in. And we need to know what our traditions are and what's good about our traditions and what's not good about our traditions. Where what's non-negotiable, it's back to that values of commanded values and personal preference values and so forth. And we all do that, but we need to be aware. We need that self-critical awareness of those things. I want to finish this. Your role and personal obligation in God's kingdom. This is a big one. And this depends on who you are and what your setting is. I tried my best early on to get out of what I ended up doing. I even tried to get out of my salvation because it was hampering me. And every time I tried, I felt like an idiot because I was so deeply convicted. My conversion was more of a from darkness to light kind of a conversion. It wasn't grow up in a church. And so consequently, when I doubted my salvation or doubted my calling, I couldn't get away from it. I just gave up. I said, I'm just being stupid here. It's pretty obvious to me what I've got to do and how I've got to pursue it. So having an awareness of your role and personal obligations in God's kingdom, all the way from being a vocational minister to being a Sunday school teacher, to being a tradesman or whatever your career is, and being a witness in that particular category. Because at the end of the day, it's not what we do. It's who we are. And yet, Christians all have that responsibility to be a thinking Christian. And not just, a floating type Christian. Your personal desires. Here's another category that's very important. The psalm says he'll give you the desires of your heart. And we know now that heart means mind. Now, obviously, it would be a stupid question to say, well, does that mean that you get evil desires. Of course not. That's the context assumes that that's not even up for grabs. Gives you the desires of your heart. God's not sitting up in heaven trying to figure out how to move you into a situation you won't like, just out of spite. God doesn't operate that way. That's our own flawed personal way of thinking. I don't know. I used to, early in Christian, I must have been influenced somehow in the church. I used to think that if I really want to do something, God will never let me do that, but God will make me do what I don't want to do. I don't know if you've ever been trapped in that kind of a mindset, but I think there was a subtle way in which sometimes churches promoted that during the dominant period of fundamentalism, because to deny yourself was the only thing that you had to worry about. Personal desires are important, and I think that we should engage them deeply. In terms of whether it's career, making decisions about marriage, living within marriage, and negotiating all the things that are involved there. We can't deny ourselves. That only leads to problems. Yeah, I think critical self-awareness probably should be the box itself. Everything goes back to that. Your personal... Because if you can't get outside of yourself, I taught some philosophy, and I always loved one book. It had this person, and it had the head open like a box, a lid, and the person came out and looked back in. I can't draw the thing well. But the fact is, it was a beautiful image of the fact that you got to stand outside yourself. When was the last time, and I'd asked myself the same question, and it's been a long time, that you made a point of getting with somebody and saying to them very specifically, what do you think of me? Don't pull any punches. You know, I mean, you're certainly not going to do it with your mate. Because, you should be able to. If we were not fallen creatures, we could do it. But we can't receive and translate correctly. We jump guns. We do all kinds of things. It just doesn't work well. But that should be a goal in a sense. And it's critical self-awareness that gets us in touch with our own personal desires. And then, of course, the big question, as it is with lots of things, why? Why is it that I like this so much? Why is it that I derive a great deal of enjoyment buying expensive instruments, driving hundreds of miles, and getting paid $25 to play until I about drop? Well, God created music. The banjo was early in his creation. David actually played the banjo. It was after the fall, unfortunately. But anyway, this thing of knowing that it does come back to knowing ourselves. This thing of critical self-awareness is repetitive in every category. The next one, inform people and friends, was mentioned by Kelly. I've never been good at that. I've had some really good people to channel me. I wish I could go back and listen better. I remember one person who ran a servicemen's center when I was in the Navy in Norfolk, and I go to Portsmouth Servicemen's Center. And he told me, he says, you need to go to Moody Bible Institute and then go to Wheaton College and then something else. That would have been a really good track, frankly. Been a very good track. But I didn't do it. And if I could go back and do my life over again, I'd do a lot of things different. If you wouldn't do a lot of things different, then you're not thinking, frankly. You're living a naive life. An unexamined life, Socrates said, isn't worth living. And I think that's very true. Inform people and friends to listen to. Doesn't mean you have to follow their advice. Job listened, and it didn't work out so well for the friends or him in some ways, but he came flying through because he stayed the course. But we do need that. We go through life, and I'd say that if we have one handful of people that we could have that conversation with, we've lived a successful life. Most of us don't have a handful. I don't know. I can get close to it, but I have to call them. They're not around. You know, they're somewhere else. The next one, and my computer got things cattywampus here. It was the council of informed people and friends. Now it's the views or approval of the community to whom you answer. Get that right in the notes there on the chart. Let me ask you, what is the biggest thing that the church community actually has control of, according to the Bible? Well, even before that.
Can I ask the question again?
What? How did I ask it? What is the most serious piece or the biggest thing or whatever that the community as a church has control of? And it's kind of first. It's a first order sort of thing. That's a personal and individual. I'm talking about the community as a community, and I can connect it to Scripture as a community obligation. It's not one you would immediately think of, unfortunately. I think it is who is qualified to do ministry. 1 Timothy chapter 3 has the qualifications for the elder and the deacons, and the deaconess. I'm not getting many grins here. I love to stir the pot, you know. In that chapter, it is not the person presenting themselves as minister or leader that counts. It's the community that makes the decision about whether they're qualified or not. Read the text. If anyone desires, and that's the word for lust. If anyone desires the office of a bishop, we Baptists translate that pastor. If anyone desires the office of a bishop, they desire a good work. Let them. And the context shows present themselves to the church, and the church is going to make judgments about them along the lines of these qualifications. It's a nice list. It's a list that's dominantly character-oriented. What's the only real, all character orientation requires skill, but what is the most obvious skill piece of that list? Teaching and administration. I'd have to go back and look at the list again. But it's mostly character traits that are there. I think culture defines the other pieces of it a great deal. But it's the church as a community that makes that decision. It's not up to individuals. In American culture, it ends up being up to the individual. If you won't do it, they'll go get somebody else to do it. Everybody does their own thing. They have their own TV program or their own radio program or their own church. How many little churches do we drive by around in this community that's been controlled by one person forever? And you can tell it by the empty parking lot, or nearly so on Sunday morning, maybe two or three families that control that situation. The view, approval of the community to whom you answer. So when major decisions are being made, it is good to have that community, and that goes back to the previous one, the Council of Informed Family and Friends. They don't make the decision for you, but they're part of the decision-making process. I don't know, did any of you ever get into Bill Gothard stuff? Good. We'll just let that go then. All right. Now, so that's just the tip of the iceberg, in a sense. The renewal of the mind touches everything about life, but decision-making is a process of thinking. And that box raises categories, and you could add categories to that that you ought to have some self-awareness about in the process. Let me give you, and I'm done. Let me give you a chart, and that we'll take some looking at. This chart moves from left to right. I don't know why there's so few of these. Did anybody get this last week? Okay. This chart I actually designed for a class of students that I could make write a paper. Yes. Okay. Anybody else want to confess? Axel, did you get one of these? Oh, okay. All right. The boss has one. That's good enough. All right. So I'll close with this. Next week, Rex is going to talk about prayer and the will of God. Then I'll be back and maybe talk a little more about this. And we've got to work out our schedule because I'm going a little bit maybe in the middle of March. I just want to do conscience and spirit because that's the big subjective domain that hangs over your head. And I leave it to last to talk about. But this process for writing the decision-making case study. Carefully state the decision to be evaluated. Please put an asterisk by that. That is one of the biggest mistakes we make. We have a question, but it's kind of obtruse. It's vague. It's not nailed. And so getting the question well defined helps. Sometimes I'll have students write case studies on that question. So it makes them think about the decision that they're dealing with. The next thing is you run the decision through the grid we've just been dealing with. You raise questions to research in order to deal with the decision. You research the questions that have been raised in the decision-making grid. You research, the Bible is going on constantly here. You bring your findings back to the decision-making grid. You list the pros and the cons. You reflect. You analyze thoroughly. Now, some people do this their whole life. They never get out of the cycle. You gotta move through, but the biggest problem is people like me, we can make amazingly quick decisions, and I've been providentially protected, I think, in many ways, because they've worked out well by and large. But that's not the way that we ought to operate. And then you state in writing, and let me highlight that. I know Kelly keeps a log. I see him making notes in an organized fashion. You state in writing the options you see within legitimate decision-making scenarios. There's nothing like putting it down on a piece of paper and looking at it. And if you're a couple and you've got some major things you're working through, do it together. Do it separate, then together maybe. Doing it separate before you do it together can sometimes get things on the table you wouldn't get there otherwise. Okay, now, so this is all these two charts basically cover a lot of these issues about processing. And when this never goes away, but for the moment it will go away from here. We'll come back to it. What I'd like to do after we finish spirit and conscience is maybe sometime have just one or two Wednesday nights where we do nothing but come together and talk about a decision. It could be your decision. You could have someone else. We can even have you write it down and give it to me if you want to keep it private. That would be perfectly good to do. And we'll work as a group on some case studies about decisions and process it through. And the first thing we'll do is process asking the question about the decision as carefully as we can. So think about that, and that'll be a few weeks down the road as we see how things flush out and when things are available. Okay, any questions? Earlier, Dave, anybody heard from Dave? Got a text or anything from Dave? The cops were all over the entry to their community. They couldn't get out. And there evidently there may have been a shooting and a bad one. So we'll find out about that later. Thank you. Have a good evening.